easy, uncomplicated, and will give you that warm and fuzzy feeling of having done something good for yourself and your community. So wax that mouse, hang 10, and surf over to kpft.org and renew your membership and pledge online at kpft.org. Thank you for supporting KPFT Houston, Radio for Peace. Mahalo.
You are listening to 90.1 FM KPFT Houston.
Listeners should be aware that the following program contains language and audio images which may be found disturbing and may not be suitable for your snotty-nosed little brat who probably cusses like a sailor behind your back anyway. Parental discretion is advised.
Greetings and welcome to tonight's very special edition of Technology Bites.
Are we going to learn something tonight?
Tonight on Technology Bites.
Is there going to be a lesson? Do we have a special guest star? No to all the above?
It's the Lee Hutchins show.
Could be.
Welcome to Technology Bites. I'm Jay Lee.
I'm Peter Hughes.
I'm Flicted.
I'm Lee.
And he's
Groove House.
Barrett is probably weasley calling from help for help from the side of a mountain somewhere in Canada.
The frozen
Yodel Barrett, yodel.
Yodel Barrett, who? Yeah, Barrett's off, he's off at foot camp. Not boot camp, but foot camp. Inside joke is funny.
Because he didn't go to boot camp.
No, if he'd gone to boot camp, he wouldn't have to go to foot camp. All right, welcome to the show. We're glad you could join us tonight. This is the Technology Bites program. We're going to be with you until 10 o'clock. And with Barrett not here, obviously, there's going to be a big gaping hole where
ew.
Great conversation once happened.
Ew.
Yeah, so visit us online at geekradio.com. You can also hang out with us in IRC in the channel Tech Bites on irc.cuckoo.com.
Cuckoo.
It is the show within a show, and I don't know what else to say. actually kind of tired tonight, so...
Don't be tired, Jay.
No, you're going to perk me up, aren't you?
We've got a whole show to do, Jay.
We've got a whole show to do, and as you know, should let you know, too, that the fundraiser is right around the corner. It's not far away.
Not this week, but soon.
Yeah, not soon, but not this week.
Not this week.
Get a head start and drop some money in the tip jar
if
for us.
If you did want to go to kpft.org and put some money in the tip jar, whatever we raise ahead of time will save us from having to raise it during the show, so that would be awesome.
And we'll say your name on air and everything.
Yeah, so that you have that working for you.
Yeah, kpft.org.
And I was stupefied to realize that the Geek Gathering is a week from Friday because we had a late Geek Gathering this month because of DEF CON, so the next Geek Gathering is rolling right around.
Aha!
So we encourage...
On the Friday of Labor Day weekend.
Awesome. Four-day weekend.
Just means everybody will be ready to get their drink on.
That's exactly what it means.
Get their labor on.
Going to labor.
Everybody going to labor.
You're going to give birth to a party.
Woo!
In the back of a cab.
Oh.
All right. So,
I'd rather not, frankly.
You'd rather not?
Can we just not?
Have we just had enough having babies?
Can we just drink?
Without having any? Oh, can we just drink? Sure. Why not? All right, so what we're going to do now is we're just going to get on with the show because get on with the show time is here.
Dang, are we scraping the bottom of the barrel? It's only 6 minutes in, Jay.
Get on with the show. This is it.
Oh, surely we've got all kinds of stuff we could talk about. I actually...
Well, we got to do the Technology Bites info shot.
We could do the info shot.
We could do. We could actually like go right on schedule here.
Oh, wow.
And try to...
Well, no, it says intro and banter has to go for at least 10 minutes. So we've got...
We're 6 minutes in. Four more minutes of
banter.
Those were all rough. That's all rough guesses, so we knew how much time...
No, we must adhere to the format. We have a format now.
What good are rules if you don't follow them?
Is that what's special about tonight's show?
Breaking the rules is no fun if somebody doesn't follow them, at least for a little while.
Banter, banter.
Banter,
banter. Banter,
witty.
Banter.
Inject insightful comment.
Skillful.
Well, one thing that we can talk about that's banter-y, banter-esque, whatever. As a possibility, I was looking, you know, The Martian is looking like a really cool movie.
It
happens to open on the first Friday of October, which might align nicely with, I don't know, some sort of 20th anniversary celebration Oh the Show thing.
If we could get a pirated that maybe copy could, of it, we could... Throw it up on the projector in the
Don't
top
look
of
at
cones.
Me. Don't look at me! Although, weirdly enough, Peter, I actually did talk. I didn't write anything on it yet, but I did talk with Matt Damon today. I got to interview him for about 10 minutes about The Martian.
Awesome. Jeez.
Yeah. We're best friends now. Me and Maddie. We're close.
And he at least has the bug in his ear to be on our show.
I did. I did push that idea to his publicist, thanks to Jay, and didn't get a no, so we'll see.
Didn't say no.
He's
a burlap.
Did you give him any Mars survival tips?
I was like, we'd like you to do the show. Say no. Oh my God.
This can't do anything but hurt your career.
That was some nice career you had once, Matt Damon.
Shame if something happened to it.
If he comes on the show, that's what's going to happen.
How do you like them apples? Yeah.
Bite of the apple. All right. Well, we're going to go ahead and end the witty banter part of our show.
It was pretty witty.
It was pretty witty. Yeah. It rhymed with a witty.
It was something.
All right. Well, let's go to Technology Bites InfoShot Central in San Antonio. Take it away, InfoShot Central. I said.
Hey.
Perfect show.
Let me try that again.
In the booth.
Ah, there we go.
It's the Technology Bites Info Shot. Technology news and commentary by Peter Hughes. Injected directly into your skull.
Okay, we start out with a mystery. The big mystery is this guy, Sanford Wallace, the Spam King. First mystery is why the hell he's free and walking around to be able to do anything. After being, you know, because he wasn't just this article I found says that Sanford Wallace, known as the Spam King, after charges alleged he sent 27 million fraudulent Facebook messages, has pled guilty to fraud and criminal contempt charges, Bloomberg reports. Now, he was the spam king long before 2011. He was the spam king on Usenet, I believe, before that, and he was a spam king of email before that, or not before that, but after Usenet. But on the plus side, he was under indictment since 2011 when the Department of Justice alleged he had compromised 500,000 real Facebook accounts through phishing spam sent in 2008 and 2009. Now, the cool part is he admitted during a hearing Monday to violating a court order banning him from Facebook, according to Bloomberg. So now he could now he faces 3 years in prison and a $250,000 fine. His sentencing is set for December 7th. So now I have to say, what's that one weird trick that you can do to go to jail for 3 years and pay her $250,000? Well, be Sanford Wallace and be an idiot. You know, the sad part is if he sent that much spam, he probably made a lot more than $250,000 off it. So, of course, they can't beat the time. It doesn't matter how much money you've got sitting waiting in the bank while you sit and rot in prison for 3 years. But I don't know. I think that that seems like a short time for somebody who's spammed that many million people. In other news, and
It sounds like he's just blown a main seal. It's
the alarm.
Robot Pete Hughes has fallen apart.
Oh, dear.
That is a glitch in the Matrix for sure.
Someone go in there and reset his record.
The record stuck.
That was wow. That was amazing.
I've never, ever heard that happen on a Skype. Is it Skype or Google Hangouts? What are we using? Google? I've never seen that on any kind of like digital audio call where somebody got stuck in a loop. That was amazing.
That was great. I want to. Is he still doing it? Can you put him back on?
Actually, I think he's talking again.
Oh. Perfect show. Shut it down now.
All right. Good night, everyone.
Just turn it back over to Pete for the rest of the evening.
Here's Peter.
Wait, is he still doing it?
It's not him doing it.
Wait,
it's he's stuck. It's
turn
like
turn it back up. Is he still doing it?
Hey, Pete.
Turn it back up.
Tech Bites is the best show. Oh, he's gone. Oh, there he is.
Isn't.
Yes, it is, Peter.
Isn't.
Why do you have to be so argumentative?
So we've still got him. So don't we just need to reboot or something? Don't we have to reboot the Peter?
Reboot Pete.
God. That is just. Okay, sorry.
Makes it all worth it. The drive, the stress.
Isn't.
Yes, it is.
Oh, Lord.
Isn't.
You know, all the time that you continue playing that is time you're not resetting the system so that we can get back to the show.
I don't know.
This is the show.
I kind of like this version of Pete. So agreeable.
That was amazing.
That was.
All right, well, we're going to try to correct the glitch in the Matrix here where Pete brings
isn't.
Lee's choking on his own petard.
I'm dying.
Oh, Lord. Okay, so we're going to try to get Pete reset here. Flicked is having way too much fun with that glitch. And we will continue on with the show. So what was he talking about?
Absolutely no idea. Was he talking about Mr. Robot?
He was talking about the Spam King.
Oh, that's right.
You know?
Spamford. Spamford Wallace.
Spamford.
Saying, man, we've been making fun of this guy for decades. I mean, was a popular figure on Slashdot.
Isn't
the spam cake here, so.
You know, I actually closed the window and started a new call, and it still did it again. And the thing is, sometimes I can see video of him. Like, not looping, but the audio is.
Can you turn off your Wi-Fi and turn it back on? Would that let it go?
Wired in.
I feel like it should be. You know, I feel like he's trapped.
No, this is.
And then we are obligated to release him from his digital torment.
This is Pete now. I mean, this is from now on. This is how it is. This is the new.
I am
the
Groot.
New way.
Is it? I am Groot.
Isn't.
All right, so the Spam King 20 years ago. Well, no, we're not making fun of him anymore. We're making fun of.
Is it? No, we've been so yeah. Spamford
so
Wallace.
Let's get a history of the Spamford Wallace.
Oh, let me see. He used to run. He used to be in charge of. He had a company, and the company was called. Geez, put me on the spot. I didn't have any of this prepared, but he had basically a multi-level marketing company, and drew the ire of internet netizens or whatever we called ourselves back in the late 90s, early 2000s by being an absolutely unrepentant spammer. Like, you know,
he's the kind of
people
person
who would
just blame the victim.
Oh, yeah. I mean,
if
people
he complained
would,
about his, what he did, he's like, just delete it.
Just delete it. People would complain. He'd get whatever email shell host he'd been set up with. They'd kick him out. And then, you know, 3 or 4 days later, he'd be back up again, sending out tremendous amounts of spam. I don't remember. It says he's potentially facing 3 years in prison and a $250,000 fine. I don't remember how much money he made, but it was one of those deals. If my ailing memory is serving me, where he had made great deals of money and then spent huge amounts of money and then made another pile and then spent another pile, and because there's been litigation against him.
Well, he was
on and off forever.
Yeah, because he was fined. Let me see.
I mean, oh my gosh, anybody who's a regular Slashdot poster.
$230 million on his activities on MySpace.
Was that for the Can Spam violations, or was this before that? Because basically, the Can Spam Act came about in no small part directly because of his actions, like that one man's actions. I mean, from his perspective, he had found something that enabled him to get a lot of money with relatively low effort, and it was high profile. He built up an online persona about it, and it was kind of his thing. It just was a really jerky thing. But he's been around forever. I'm actually kind of surprised to see him popping up again. When I saw this news item come up, I thought it was about, like, somebody else who was calling themselves the Spam King. But nope, good old Spamford Wallace. Pretty amazing. One of those names that you thought you were done with, like, 10 years ago, and he comes back again. Now, there's a name I haven't heard for a long time.
Well, you know, a lot of what we know as spam today was created by him and his company.
Absolutely, yeah.
So
directly
and other
by
people, and when people saw how much money he was able to pay in fines, they realized that there was money to be made in the spam business. And
yeah, because I mean, it's a relatively low barrier to entry, and even if you know 0.00001% of people respond to it, that's enough. Although. If I'm remembering right, he wasn't hawking anything. He made his money by being the in-between, the middleman, providing the spam, taking money from the you know, herbal Viagra makers of the world,
right.
Turning around and sending the emails on their behalf. So it didn't really matter what the click-through was, because he was getting paid either way.
Right. He is just providing the mechanism for which these companies could advertise their products.
Brilliant stuff. Don't do it, though, because it is, in fact, illegal.
How is it illegal?
It's exactly. So illegal. It's prohibited under there's an act called CAN Spam, and in typical congressional fashion, it's actually an acronym for something ridiculous. I have no idea what it is. But yeah, Jay's Googling, and we have pictures of cans of spam.
The can spam.
Yeah, but it's there are limits on the sending of unsolicited commercial email in bulk, defined under the Can Spam Act. The act also defines, if I remember right, the ways in which companies must provide unsubscribe links, and lays out what an acceptable business relate, because, you know, companies are allowed to send you, you know, finger quotes, unsolicited email if you have an existing business relationship with them.
Main requirements: don't use false or misleading header information,
right?
Your from, to, reply to, and routing information, including the originating domain name and email address, must be accurate and identify the person or business who initiated the message. Do not use deceptive subject lines. The subject line must accurately reflect the content of the message. This is spam.
Right.
Identify the message as an ad. The law gives you a lot of leeway on how to do this, but you must disclose clearly and conspicuously that your message is an advertisement.
Yep.
4, tell recipients where you're located. 5, tell recipients how to opt out of receiving. And that number 5 actually has been playing very well into. I mean, it's unfortunate because most people aren't going to send you a message again anyway, but every time I get an advertisement from a press release or something, or somebody trying, they will give you an opt out. There's a way to opt out.
Yeah.
And which is nice, but I feel like I shouldn't have to opt out if somebody never opted into.
Why
in the
do
first
you have
place.
My email in the first place?
Except the side effect is when you opt out, I think that
validates
means
your email address.
Sometimes.
Yeah.
And the one of the key ways to tell whether it's going to be like, hey, this validates my email address or a legitimate opt out, is to look at the email service that the email comes in from, because there are two really big ones. One's called MailChimp and one is called Mailgun. MailChimp and Mailgun that are legitimate email services. You can use them if you have like a personal blog or whatever and you don't want to set up your own email and you don't want to use Gmail. You can use MailChimp for free to send emails like new post notifications on your blog. They also have paid tiers that businesses can use. MailChimp and Mailgun both are very, very good about properly honoring unsubscription requests. But if it's, you know, some, you know, fake Nigerian prince trying to get you to get his millions of dollars out of his country and he has an unsubscribe link, chances are that's not a legit unsubscribe link. Also, chances are that's not a legit Nigerian prince, just in case.
Well, it kind of boils down to being able to identify anything valid or invalid on the internet, which is something that
it's a hard thing sometimes.
We struggle with. We all struggle with. I mean, I've gotten caught by parody sites and things like that. I mean, it sometimes does become difficult to know. You know, I consider myself pretty good at being able to tell if something is, air quote, legitimate or not.
Mm-hmm.
But not a lot of people just, they have no savvy in that regard, and they don't know. And there's not a way to tell somebody how you do that.
It's very difficult. It's a skill that you pick up by you know, exposure to the horrible junk that's out there. You just sort of learn to discern what's legit and what isn't. Back when Spamford was just starting out, actually before that, in the 80s, prior to the advent of the web at all, when the internet was still a relatively small thing, right, through the 70s and 80s, originally email servers, when the email specification was established, were by default what are called open relays, in that an email server wouldn't just send email from you, like if it's your email server, I could email you. And say, hey, your email server, hey, Peter's email server, would you send this email for me? My email address is, you know, giveyoumillionsofdollars.com, and send it to like 10,000 people, if you would, please. And you don't need my login credentials, just send it for me. And that was like the out-of-the-box configuration for most email servers, for send mail and all the other ones that were generally working back then. It was an open, trusting relationship that very, very quickly, once people figured out that they could, you know, sell spam and unsolicited commercial email, very quickly was perverted. And then the practice of having open relay email servers died out very, very quickly. Now it's not something you ever see. In fact, if your server is configured as an open relay, if you are setting up an email server and you somehow manage to screw up and configure it as an open relay, you'll find yourself on every single email blacklist that there is, and you will never get off of them. Because, I mean, as soon as that happens, you become like a spam relay instantly.
Yeah, as soon as people discovered that your SMTP was wide open to the public, then people would cram their mail through your porthole.
Essentially, more than half the mail on the internet is spam.
Oh, yeah, it's something like 80%.
And which, you know, it's sort of sad because you're talking about major companies that make a whole lot of money off of being on the internet and or having something related to it, who are essentially kind of allowing it. We've turned it into where it's on the user or it's on the receiver to try and stop the spam.
Email's one of those weird mediums where it's like actually kind of amazing that it works at all, because there has to be at this point, there has accreted so much spam filtering and logic on at all levels of the stack that like it's absolutely amazing legit email goes through at all. It's like it's like the process of like flushing a toilet but in reverse, like into your inbox every day that you have to filter out, and it's amazing that it works, but it does.
Yeah, but the thing is, if they really made it where you had to legitimately sign your email, or where you could be sure that it really was coming from who you thought it was coming from, then a large percentage of this, the reason it can be 80% is because essentially the pipes for your email are an open sewer and anybody can dump what they want into it. And it's on you to filter out the garbage when it gets to your place. Which, you know, it shows, you know, basically, I guess it shows the same attention to security detail that we've talked about with airplanes and cars and anything that has the internet in it, where they just leave it wide open or rely on security through obscurity. And so far it hasn't, yes, we've managed to make a way for it to work, but it's really, it's sort of sad how ineffective it is. And I think that may be part of why millennials apparently don't use email very much at all.
Really?
Oh, yeah. Yeah,
millennials. They chat and texts and things like that because you can be sure, you know, you don't get – when you get a text from somebody that isn't someone in your address book or somebody that you know that you've called before, you can tell immediately that it's not somebody you know.
Email is like faxing to them. It's just something old people do.
Yeah, they can't avoid it, and they can't avoid receiving it. But it, you know, so it's just unfortunate that nobody's come up with a better solution than just trying to stop. You know, you'd think that some of these things, these large scale ones, that like a Gmail, when there's 1,000 copies that, well, I guess that's where you can see that one of the things they've done. Sometimes when one comes through malformed, you can tell what they're doing. Basically, they're taking books and digitizing them, and then it's putting random paragraphs from the book in the email, which makes it really difficult for the large-scale filters to catch that it's the same email because the majority of it is different.
Right.
But
yeah, and a lot of times anyway. The filtering is done by what are called Bayesian filters, which are learning filters that look at patterns of language and snarfing, you know, sections from books is a way to confuse that because it is natural language. It may not make sense to you as a human being that you've got a copy of text from like the middle of Robinson Crusoe in the middle of your email, but it's enough to pass a filter.
Yeah, I found I got to a point where the volume was so much and it was in my inbox that it was that I sat down and came up with the set of rules and filters that have it down to where maybe I get there's 100 emails that I have to evaluate in a given day.
Yep. And even after that, like those 100 emails, there's like 1,000 that were filtered out before you even saw them.
Right. Right. So, but yeah, I one of the best filters, if you're using, well, one of the other things is stuff only gets into my inbox after it passes the filters. I have a junk review folder. So that if something's in there and I just get behind and there's a bunch of stuff, I can just delete all that and I'm not really worried that it's anything from somebody that knows me. But the biggest thing, you know, if you want to look on any of your email clients, you can put a filter on that says, okay, if this email didn't come from somebody who's in my address book or that I've emailed that I've sent email to, then, you know, then you can put a rule and basically tell it to put it somewhere where you put it in a folder that you can check later and you're not in as much, you know, there's not as much of a risk of losing something. Because the worst thing and the nightmare is people who you know, in business, especially, I support businesses on their, with their, some of their IT stuff. And when one of, for whatever reason, when one of the domains of a business partner or business company you're doing business with gets in the spam, gets labeled as spam.
Yeah.
And nothing flakes out a boss faster than figuring out that they got an email a week ago from a client and it went in their spam folder and they never saw it. So,
Well, I kind of blame really good spam filtering for the spam problem because it's kind of taken it out of sight and out of mind. So, you know, like Gmail does such a good job of filtering out all my spam that I don't see it unless I go look at it. So I'm thinking I'm living a relatively spam-free life. And what's really bad, the double-edged sword, is at work. You know, we have our corporate mail servers. We use some very high-end, sophisticated spam filtering software, which, does a really good job. If you go and look at your spam folder from work, people that have published their work email addresses, or if there are, you know, a lot of companies get their email lists compromised in a number of different ways. But then, say, a piece of spam gets through, and then people get all freaked out, you know, like, oh, my God, I got a piece of spam. It's like, no, you got a lot more than a piece. That one just slipped through.
Right.
And why didn't you block it? It had, you know, you could tell from the language, it had no actual curse words. It had very suggestive language in it. But it was a completely legitimate looking email. The spam filters had no way of knowing it was spam. And so they erred on the side of caution and they delivered you the message.
Yeah.
And I think people don't always appreciate, you know, how hard it is to block all that stuff out. And then if they want to whine and complain about getting a spam message once every couple of weeks or something like that, just it's ridiculous how spoiled people are when it comes to spam. I think we should just have a release the hounds day of email.
Yeah, I've always told everybody at work, because I actually built and ran the spam, hand-built spam gateways for a number of years, and then we got in products, and I was responsible for running them. And, you'd get somebody, like a one or two spam messages get through, and they would just be livid. And I was like, you know,
like you're not doing your job.
Yeah. Like,
you're not doing your job.
We need to have a spam appreciation day where we just turn off everything at the border, and just let everything in for one day, and then maybe they'll appreciate, like, what they're not getting.
Well, I'm one of those crazies. I run my own email server. I do. It's a postfix box. I use Dovecot for IMAP and stuff. But the spam filtering solution that I use is a free one. It's called Spam Assassin. It's very common. It's hugely widely used. I use that in conjunction with a bunch of other stuff. And you can actually sit there and watch if you tail the mail log file. You can sit there. In fact, I can do it right now, and we'll probably see something come by if you give it just a second or so. You can just watch it, and it's like 24 hours a day. If you're ever bored, you can just like tap in and look at the mail log file, and you can be like, "There, spam discarded, spam discarded, spam, 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 spam discarded." And it's like it's just this constant like flow of activity of this thing dumping mail out because there's just so much of it.
Yeah,
it's everywhere.
One trick that I like that stops the people who are spoofing, you know, that are pretending to be some server they're not, is called gray listing. And what it does is the first time a mail comes to the server, with a temporary message. Like basically, I temporarily can't accept this. You know, resend it, and then all the illegitimate stuff, the stuff that's faking it, of course, it's going to bounce to the legitimate address it's pretending to come from. And when that server gets it, it's just going to ignore it. And so then you don't even have to process it. And if it's legit, the server's going to remember and resend later, you know, 5 minutes later. So the first time you get an email from somebody, there might be a 5 or 10 minute delay while their server resends it. But then you know that it's somebody legit and there's some, you know, at least filters out that piece of the illegitimate part of the web.
Well, see, and when you're talking about looking in your logs and seeing spam assassin messages that say discarded, you're probably only seeing 10% of the spam messages that are trying to get to your system. I'm assuming you're running RBLs probably, right?
So, oh, yeah. No, I see.
Yeah, so that stuff's not even going to show up as discarded.
It does. I see from the connect attempts on, so I'll see if it gets bounced by the initial process. I'll see if it gets trapped in Anvil. I'll see if it gets kicked out by one of the RBLs. And then if it passes all that, I'll see it get graded and then kicked into the junk mail folder for, like, managing to, like, navigate the gauntlet and then getting stuck in the Bayesian filter. It's just, you know, it's neat. It's actually kind of calming. You can just sit there and watch it go. And there you go.
So, Pete, you know what happened? Uh-oh.
Oh, no. Is it?
Now. I don't want to relive that.
It's too soon.
Too soon. Did we lose him again? At least we didn't lose him in such a spectacular fashion. Of course, Lee's wife is having a lot of fun on Twitter with that.
<She's>, isn't? Yes. Yes, it is.
Pete, you got stuck in a weird loop. You said the word isn't, and then it just kept repeating infinitely.
Like for isn't, minutes.
Isn't for minutes upon minutes.
And I wonder, I would guess the problem was at Google Hangouts somewhere because, you know, well, on my end, I could see when I wasn't talking, there's on Google Hangouts, there's
audio meter.
It shows you there's a little audio meter that goes, and it was constantly going. The thing is, I mean, I disconnected from the call and then reconnected, and it was still doing it. Hmm. We did a new, you know, we quit the... flicked it neither. We started a new call. So I don't know what either it was something that got horked on in the audio area on Flicted's, you know, tied in with the problem of Google Hangouts or something. But that was not pleasant.
Technology bites.
It was amazing. Well, I had to listen to the podcast. It was incredible.
It was transcendental.
Well, so we've got through talking about some of the other stories in the news.
Yeah, bring it.
Okay. Well, this one, I think this is probably, if I'm right, where I got to, I started to talk about that this was related to Gamergate indirectly, at
Careful
least what
now.
It was ostensibly about. There's a game coming out called Metal Gear Solid 5 that maybe two or three of you are aware of. It's a big deal. But the thing, this is an article from Forbes. And by the way, there are links to all the articles that we used for reference in the show tonight at geekradio.com up on the front page underneath the Geek Gathering announcement, the second item during that. But the new thing is game review media events. So apparently, if you see any reviews for Metal Gear Solid 5, it's called Metal Gear Solid 5, The Phantom Pain, the only reviews that you're going to see are from reviewers who went to those boot camps. There's a small handful of critics who are well-connected enough to get a review copy before launch, but everybody else now, the industry controls the access entirely.
Is this ethical? It's all about the ethics.
No, it's absolutely not ethical, but it's also, it's kind of a double-edged sword, right? So the deal is, do you want to review the game? Because if you don't review the game, if you're a mid to top tier site, you're giving up on, this is a AAA title, you're giving up on, potentially a lot of traffic, which means a lot of ads that you won't be able to put in front of eyeballs. So, do you want to pay your writers? Because if you do, then you have to play the game. And by play the game, I don't mean the Metal Gear Solid 5 game. I mean the review junket game.
But Apple kind of does that too, right? They control who gets access to review.
That's a little
things.
Different because when you go to an Apple event, Apple isn't paying to fly you out there, and Apple isn't paying for your hotel room and trying to dictate the experience to you. In a lot of cases, these review events are paid for by companies. It's actually, there are similar issues in automotive journalism. If you are a car journalist writing about a new Ferrari or whatever, I'm picking Ferrari out of the air, but any new fancy car, chances are that you're there on the automaker's dime. both for your hotel and your meals and your flight. It's like that for media, a lot of movie journalism, film journalism. If you want access to a film pre-release and you want to talk to the actors and the directors, you have to do it at their junket, which is always invite only on their dime. I mean, it's in a lot of industries. Game journalism is a little weird, though, because it's one of those things to where it's relatively, I don't want to devalue, you know, writers, but it's relatively easy to break into game journalism at the amateur level. You know, set up a blog, play some video games, talk about what you love. But making that graduation from an amateur video game blogger to a finger quotes pro video game blogger, a for pay video game blogger, is very difficult. And once you,
because you have to have a crazy voice and act weird on YouTube.
PewDiePie! Often, yes. But I mean, like, if you want to go the traditional route and work for a publication or whatever, getting access to these kind of industry events, these, you know, junkets, basically, is a huge step. It's a big thing. And if you work for BigGiantMediaCompany.com, a lot of times you've got the option to pay your own way to get into these kind of things. You know, you can tell the company, I'd like to attend, but we have to do our own expenses. But if you're, you know, writing for Bob's video game site, which is you and your four buddies, and you score an invite to Konami's Metal Gear Solid 5 press event, absolutely, you're going to take, because you can't afford the plane ticket, the hotel, or whatever. And so, yeah, then that leads to the situation where all of the video game reviews, except for a very handful of them, are written by journalists who are there on the company's dime. And that's ethically extremely problematic. A lot of them will disclose it, and they'll say, you know, we accepted free travel and free room and board from company X to during this event. And some of them won't. And it goes a lot farther, too. There's always accusations of pay for play, right? There's always accusations of publishers saying that, you know, we'll give you access if you give the game a good review, and if you give the game a bad review, then you won't be attending our next game launch event. And that's potentially, you know, huge amounts of money that they don't get. It's just a cruddy, dirty industry, and the big sites are somewhat insulated from it by being financially independent. But game journalism is not a large industry, as big as video games are. And they're enormous. I mean, the video game industry combined, the consoles plus computers and everything together, makes more money than the film industry these days. Billions and billions and billions of dollars. And weirdly, as big as that is, the game journalism industry, dedicated game journalism, not like hybrid sites that have a pet game journalist, but dedicated video game journalist sites, are very, very, very small, because it's just very difficult to make money in it. So that was kind of a long-winded, like, side, like, digression there on the subject of video game journalism and these press junkets. But yeah, totally agree. Forbes has a great point. They're extremely problematic, and there's really not a lot to be done about it, because it would require change on both sides of the table. And frankly,
does
I think
this prop up the Gamergate people, or does this
one of the complaints that Gamergate has is about that's kind of their rallying cry, is it's about ethics and video game journalism, and this kind of paid review thing is this kind of junket kind of system that's evolved, where often you have to accept the company's dime in order to get access to the game, is one of the things that ostensibly the mass disorganized group that calls themselves Gamergate is against. Yes.
Although one piece that's mentioned in the article is Gamergate focuses on indie developers who have direct relationships with journalists. So they don't really say much at all about this kind of large scale, you know, which is worse, that somebody who's got an indie game development company has some kind of friendship relationship with a journalist, or somebody who pays for your room and board, feeds you, supplies you with the equipment, you know, controls what you see and experience for a week.
Well, yeah, both are skeevy in their own way. I mean, you know,
right. If it's not disclosed.
No, exactly. I mean, So if I'm buddies with, you know, some indie developer, and he knows I work for Ars Technica, and he comes to me and he's like, hey, Lee, would you write up this indie game I'm working on, because we've known each other forever and went to school together and we're buddies? I would have absolutely no problem doing it, but you can damn well bet the first words out of my virtual mouth in the article are like, I know the developer, we grew up together, this is probably going to be a pretty favorable impression because we're friends, and then you write it.
He paid me in s'mores.
Exactly. It's when you don't disclose that going in that it becomes extremely problematic. I mean, nobody... when you... Not to digress further, but when you write a review, whether it's a game or a phone or whatever, there's always a subjective component to it. People are there to read what you think. And as a journalist, you try to give take the audience on an experiential ride and show them or describe to them the things that you liked and didn't like and felt when you're with this gadget or this game or this movie or whatever. It's always experiential. I mean, if you're not reading an experiential review, you're reading a bad review, frankly, because then it's just somebody listing a spec sheet.
Right. Well, being objective when you're doing that kind of thing is tough, too, because it requires a certain amount of willingness to hurt people's feelings.
Oftentimes. And you have to know... There is a difference between being just blatantly subjective and being like, this game sucks, I don't like it, and then being able to say, here's what I like about it, here's what I didn't like about it, I can see how other people might like this this part because X, Y, and Z, and if that's what you're going for, this is a good game. Just I'm making these, you know, fake examples up, but like, you have to be conscious of the fact that everybody is different. And the things that you hate about something may not necessarily be wonderful, lovely things.
Do you ever turn down an opportunity to review a product because you know in advance that you're probably not going to like it?
No. Oftentimes, those kind of reviews can be really fun, both because they're fun to write and also because it's interesting to challenge yourself and take something that you're pretty sure you're going to hate and give it an honest look. And examine your own prejudices against whatever it is, like 3D printers. I'm so sick of 3D printers, but I have one that I'm reviewing right now, and it's actually kind of neat.
The best review I ever got, somebody reviewed one of my band's CDs.
Yeah.
And they said, the Flying Fish Sailor CD, Give Me Coffee, was an album I thought I'd hate.
What?
But,
and then I hated it.
They went on to criticize it appropriately, but I like the idea that they came out and said, you know, that I was predisposed to not liking this for a number of reasons.
Yeah.
As opposed to the review of our second CD from Dirty Linen Magazine that said, Flying Fish Sailor CD, Remnant Stew tries real hard.
Gets a participation medal.
Also attended. Also recorded. So it's a difficult, especially with, I would think too, in the land of social media where, you know, people call people out for being bullies or being rude or being mean. You know, if you can't say something nice, don't say something at all. So if you write an honest review about something and it includes things you don't like and things that are disparaging to the game or to the product, other people have instant platform to like lash out at you and say, you know, how dare you, you know, these people are trying to, you know, do whatever, blah, blah, blah. And they respond to the criticism from an emotional standpoint, not from, you know, trying to be an educated consumer about such things.
And so, I mean, typically the way you try to respond to that, whether it's a game review or a product review or a movie review or a song review or whatever, in my experience is you try to kill them with kindness and be funny about it. And 5% of the people are going to hate you no matter what. And those are the 5% you can pretty much safely write off. They're the people who are tweeting you death threats at 3 a.m. because you didn't like their game. There's just nothing you can do about that. And another like 5% are going to absolutely love you and worship you no matter what you say, because you know they love the site you write for, or they love something about you, you know, whatever. And
or
those
they also
people,
hate it.
Yeah, well, and those people you can, as much as you love unadulterated praise, those people you can typically write off too because they're not doing you any favors. But the remainder of 90% of people, honestly, even folks who are borderline crazy, will respond to. You know, and I'm not talking about engage everybody and spend your entire day answering internet comments, but just, you know, be intelligent about it. Try to anticipate criticisms in what you say, And like if, you know, you go into, let's take Metal Gear Solid 5 as an example. The Metal Gear series has been out for a long time. I've played a couple of them. It's about a guy. His name is Solid Snake. He's like a secret agent, spy, cyborg dude, and he sneaks around and spies and stuff and kills people, and there's giant robots. And it's actually an incredibly complicated series with a pretty huge cinematic component to it. There's like hours of cutscenes in each game. And it's like a common dig against the series is it's like ridiculously over artistic and super uber dramatic and just like so incredibly overblown. But there's, it also has a really nice element of self-parody to it sometimes, which is always kind of neat. And so you go to review this game and you know off the top of your head going in that it's probably going to be, there's going to be like guys walking in slow motion with explosions, and there's like a dove flies off this way and somebody cries and fall. And it's going to be like, there's going to be a lot of cliche in it. And you can gig the game for that, but at the same time, that's kind of its core thing. So you have to accept it and talk it up too. I don't know. It's like you've got to, you don't ever have to dig for something to love about anything that you review. And you usually don't have to dig for anything you hate about something you're trying to review. But the key is to approach it from, even though you are subjective no matter what you do, the key is to approach it recognizing and calling out your own subjectivity and then at least trying to hold it up to a critical lens. And if you do that, most people tend to like what you'll write, even if they disagree with what you're saying. I don't know how we got on this far down this. I mean, I'm happy to talk about it. This is fun, but I don't know how we got this far down.
In other news, burning the hour. Got a few other things, and one that sadly, you know, we may have to talk about in the second hour, but that ties in Mr. Robot and some other things. But this one's a quickie. If you've flown, as I'm sure Lee, and tried to use in-flight Wi-Fi, you may have noticed it ain't the quickest.
I tweeted out my displeasure with Southwest Airlines Wi-Fi that I paid the $8 for on my way out to San Diego for Comic-Con, and Southwest contacted me and refunded me my $8.
Well, that's no skin off their back, that's a nice gesture.
It was a nice gesture.
And I was on an Embraer, a brand new Embraer 175, a United flight back from LaGuardia last week, which LaGuardia to Intercontinental is 3.5 hours. And the plane was, in fact, so new that it had no hot galley, no Wi-Fi, no screens, no drink service. There's nothing. It's like they rolled this thing out of like the Embraer factory, threw a crew on it.
It was an embryo.
It was an embryo. And there was nothing, man. It was like I was back in 1987 flying, except there was better food in 1987.
And they're fairly loud inside, right? That's the little one with the like two seats on one side.
No. These are new. They're an upgrade over like the Canadian regional jet, the CRJs. There was it's 2x2 seating in economy, and it's 1x2 seating, and there was a separate first class section, 1x2 in first class where I was, and then 2x2 in the back, and it holds a fair amount of people. It was like a tiny jet.
All right. Well, I think Pete had a part of this story that wasn't about your flight.
Oh yeah, no. I just like talking about me.
I like talking about my flight. So anyway, so now we've kind of described what in-flight Wi-Fi can be like or not.
Right.
Yeah, one of the companies that serves like Air Canada, Alaska Airlines, American Airlines, Delta, United, and Virgin America is called Gogo. And right now their service is 3.1 megabits per second. That's per plane, I believe. And they have a new version that's coming out that's been approved by the FAA that's up to 70 megabits per second. And they're hoping to launch that later this year. So they changed their technology. Apparently, it's easier to install and simpler than the old one. Although the data plans include a 24-hour pass for $16 and an unlimited monthly pass for $60. But, you know, the best thing is if the competition is about increasing speed, that can't be a bad thing on flights because, you know, it doesn't take very much to saturate a 3.1 megabits connection.
They should work on the speed of the plane, just getting us to the destination faster instead of trying to placate us while we sit on the tarmac for hours.
Make plane go faster. Why plane fly slow?
Well, it's not about, it wasn't planes, but trains. I saw this, it was on the top stuff of Reddit, that in 1970, that you could go from New York City to Washington, D.C. on the train, and it took like 2.5 hours. And now with the high speed, you know, super high speed, the fastest train in the United States, the Acela, you can get from New York City to Washington, D.C. in 3 hours.
Oh, Amtrak, never changed.
And it's like, what happened? But other news, just real quick before we have to go and we can pick some of it back up. The Mr. Robot finale was supposed to be tonight, and it has been postponed because apparently it included a scene that was too similar to the Virginia TV station shooting. So they are not going to show the episode tonight.
Spoilers, I guess.
They didn't elaborate on how the scene is similar to the events today, but, you know, I mean, you can kind of narrow it down a little bit.
Somebody got shot on camera, I'm guessing.
Yeah.
So there's that. And then something that I had on earlier, Afflicted found that one. Earlier, Wired has an interesting article that, especially for a show that's about hacking that does a better job of being more realistic and not crazy and stupid like many other shows, they have a peek inside Mr. Robot's toolbox, and they talk about, you know, there may be some spoilers to some of this, but, you know, it's to the season finale, so, you know, I'll give you a chance while I say this. You can, you know, cover your ears and go la 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 and wait for us to go to announcements or whatever in a couple of minutes. But they go through a list of some of the different of the different software in that they've shown in the episode, like Deep Sound. You know, the thing, if you're wondering why someone who'd fry his computer to memory chip in the microwave would be careless enough to store evidence of people he's hacked on CD-ROMs disguised as CDs, then Elliot's one step ahead of you because he used Deep Sound, an audio converter tool, to hide the files within WAV and FLAC audio files, basically steganography, which we've talked about before, but that's real software that does it. Let's see, the Proton Mail. It's a browser-based email service incorporated in Switzerland and created by the researchers who met at a CERN research facility. We can come back with some more after the
break. Yeah, we can talk about that a little bit more after the
break. Yeah, definitely.
All right, well, that music tells us we have to take a few minutes, do some station business, so we'll be right back after this station business. You're listening to Technology Bites. I'm Jay Lee.
I'm Peter Hughes.
I'm Flicted.
I'm Lee.
And he's...
Groovehouse.
You can find KPFT on the social networking sites Twitter and Facebook? You certainly can, and we'd love you to add us as a friend and get us connected with friends of yours. Join our fan page and check out a special video message from General Manager Dwayne Bradley, as well as keep up with KPFT programmers and staff. Visit facebook.com/KPFT Houston to join us. To follow us, visit twitter.com/KPFT. With both, you can link up with other KPFT listeners, get the latest news about the station, and find lots of extras. It's fun. So catch up with KPFT online. Again, on Twitter, visit twitter.com/KPFT. On Facebook, visit us at facebook.com/KPFT Houston. This is commercial-free, listener-sponsored Pacifica Radio, 90.1 KPFT Houston.
Usted probablemente ha estado en su carro buscando por coberturas de noticias o buscando alguna música nueva. O a lo mejor usted estuvo en su casa cambiando el cuadrante buscando algo diferente. Su radio probablemente se haya quedado en KPFT y permanecido allí. Si usted es un nuevo radioescucha de esta estación, esta es la manera en que la radio de la comunidad trabaja. Nosotros dependemos de radioescuchas, no de comerciantes, para obtener dinero que usamos para la operación de nuestra estación. Nosotros tenemos campañas de donaciones pocas veces al año, donde nosotros le pedimos a usted que apoye nuestro trabajo con una donación monetaria. Usted ha venido dependiendo de nosotros, pero nosotros dependemos de usted. Vaya a la página de internet www.kpft.org para hacer su donación monetaria. Esta es libre de comerciales, patrocinada por Radio Escuchas. Radio Pacífica, KPFT, Houston.
You're listening to 90.1 FM KPFT Houston. We now return you to Not Mr. Robot.
Isn't it
like Mr. Robot? Is it? Okay. Welcome back to Technology Bites.
We're glad you time for a very special Barrett time.
Barrett's gone.
Barrett.
All right. So. Now resume Technology Bites, already in progress. Rockers.
Okay, back to Mr. Robot's toolbox. Proton Mail, the cool thing is that it's end-to-end encryption in a way that even the owners of Proton Mail can't see your content, and there's no IP logging, said Michael Bazell, one of the technical advisors on the show. It even lets you set expiration dates for your emails, after which they'll self-destruct. Of course, provided the recipient hasn't made a copy of them. Proton Mail is free, although obviously there's a wait list for invitations to create an account. They also have just announced beta versions of iOS and Android mobile apps, and you can jump higher in the line if you're interested in Proton Mail with a $29 donation. The next batch of invites will be released Thursday. Some other ones, Raspberry Pi, we've talked about that here. That's obviously a real thing. This one, Tastic RFID Thief. When visiting Steel Mountain, F Society member Mobley was armed with Bishop Fox's Tastic RFID Thief, which is a long-range radio frequency identification reader that basically scans for badge information from RFID badges and saves it on an micro SD card as a text file so you can clone the badge later. That's real. It's completely portable. It fits neatly into a messenger bag or briefcase. Let's see some other ones. Kali Linux. Backtrack's Linux successor is a Debian-based version of Linux. It's specifically built for penetration testing and security auditing and is used in multiple episodes of Mr. Robot.
That was one of those where he was using Kali Linux when he used the SET, the social engineering tool, when he sent the fake text messages, so it appeared to come from somebody else.
Sneaky.
And it's funny because a few days after that, the guy who creates the SET tool actually released an update to the tool, and the update was codenamed Mr. Robot.
Well, yeah, so basically, since this is a tool for penetration testing and security auditing, that means it's got all kinds of stuff already there for you to built in to check security vulnerabilities on. Since it's made for your network, you can also point it at others. John the Ripper, another one, a tool that Elliot used in the second episode of the show to crack Terrell's password. Its primary purpose is to detect weak Unix passwords, but it can crack weak passwords with several thousand or even several million attempts per second. John the Ripper is available within the Kali Linux platform. Let's see, Metasploit and Meterpreter. That was from episode 6, apparently. The company's called Rapid7, makes the Metasploit framework. It's an exploit development and delivery system that allows users to create execute exploits, typically for penetration testing. It saves hackers time because they don't have to learn a new tool each time they want to run an exploit.
Yeah, it was funny in the show because in the show he instead of saying Rapid 7, he said Rapid 9. he was like mad that it didn't work, and he was like, "What, did you just go grab something off of Rapid 9?"
An interpreter is just one of several hundred payloads that can be used within Metasploit. It resides entirely in memory and writes nothing to disk, but can give an attacker control of their target system and parts of the network. It's often used within Kali Linux on a virtual machine in Windows or on Windows itself. Social Engineer Toolkit, an open source pen testing framework designed specifically for simulating social engineering attacks such as phishing, spear phishing, credential harvesting, and more. Elliot used SMS spoofing from within SET, a module that's unavailable on the newer versions, but Mr. Robot Tech Advisor Michael Bazell said that it's possible for users to add that package back in within the new version. So kids, so script kiddies are learning all kinds of new things from Mr. Robot. And then finally, the list would be remiss without the inclusion of a tool used by one of the show's less sympathetic characters. On the third episode of Mr. Robot, Terrell Wellick secretly installs mobile monitoring software on a lover's Android phone. After gaining root privilege by using SuperSU, he installs FlexiSpy, a tool that lets you monitor other people's device activities with an online portal. FlexiSpy doesn't recover past data, but can show you anything still stored on the phone's memory or SIM card, as well as anything in the future. It also hides SuperSU as part of its installation. So, it's nice that they're using realistic tools that you could actually find and use. Hopefully the people who've learned about this will learn to that these things exist and to take some precautions. But there's also certainly going to be a category of people who are going to learn, who are going to want one for themselves and to use for good purposes or bad.
Yes.
But these things really exist. It has to exist for, the white hats, because you can't test, your security if you don't have tools that can try to compromise it. So, the sort of kudos to Wired for taking and kind of going through it and looking at what they're using and writing it up.
We're losing Peter again.
He's fading out.
He's fading out.
His connection isn't what it used to be.
Isn't it?
Pete!
the connection kind of comes and goes. I could hardly hear you guys when you started talking.
We could hardly hear you. So now you're back.
Oh, great.
We're glad you're back.
So.
All right. So, yeah, I'm a little disappointed that I'm not going to get to go home tonight and watch Mr. Robot. Last week's episode was... Have you been watching it?
I haven't yet. I was going to wait till the season was complete and then try to binge watch it. Yeah.
Okay. Well, I won't spoil it for you, but last week was a revelation. Fight Club. All right, so
Sixth Sense.
Sixth Sense.
Well, the other, I guess, technology
some
story.
Memento.
Yeah. But anyway, hopefully it'll be back next week, and then it'll be gone for ever. Probably until summer of 2016 or something like that.
Yeah, I hate that. I hate that trend. The trend that it feels like more and more TV shows are doing. Maybe I'm just getting old and complaining about stuff, but I mean...
That's why I liked introducing myself to Breaking Bad like 3 or 4 seasons in, because yeah. I was able to binge watch it for a long time.
We did the exact... Me and Laura did the same thing. We got into Breaking Bad during one of the hiatuses, and we watched like 4.5 seasons over the course of like a month and a half.
Right.
And then we were like, wait, what? I think we ended with Hank on the toilet with the revelation that he has in the bathroom with the Walt Whitman book. And that was like where we stopped. And that, of course, is one of the biggest, smash cliffhangers in the entire series. We stopped there and then had to wait like months before we got to pick it back up again. To find out what was going to happen.
It's Better Call Saul coming back.
I don't know. But yeah, it just like seems like shows are doing this. Like they'll they'll do like these mid-season hiatuses or they'll do short seasons. I mean, isn't a show supposed to run 22 episodes? Isn't like 22 to 24 episodes
not
over
anymore,
the course like of a year like the normal way
12,
of things?
12. Yeah. 12 to 16 if you're lucky.
It's like, this isn't the BBC. This is America. Our shows are 24 episodes long.
Yeah, it's like back in the day when records were 45 minutes.
I know, and you got good cover art on a big 45
piece
RPM
of cardboard.
Yeah. And it cost a quarter, and you hooked it onto your belt when you left the store because the Kaiser had stolen all of our paper bags.
It was the style of the time.
It was the style at the time. We didn't call them zeros. We called them deities.
All right. So we've covered that. So we want to go into the next segment of the show. Pete?
Sure.
All right.
All right.
Actually, I have to pump up the volume. Pump up the volume.
Wait, which one of these are we doing?
Bite.
Oh, that one. I have so many feelings.
The la 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 becomes a lot more crazy after the organ music.
I just don't know how I'm supposed to, what emotions I'm supposed to have after listening to that. Fear. Consumerism.
Happy fear.
Happy fear.
Happy fear.
There you go. Well,
I'm terrified, but it's funny. Run for your
life. Well, so a few things from Apple for this week. There's nothing interesting in the new rumors for what's coming out, but as far as the upcoming phones thing, September 9th is looking more and more solid, or that somewhere around it is looking more and more solid for the day of the. So we're not that far away from learning about the iPhone 6S and so on. Interesting things, you know, the Apple Watch, there's been lots of back and forth about, you know, what are the sales like? Because Apple won't say what the sales numbers are. But one thing that does say something about how the sales numbers are is Best Buy has been selling Apple Watches at some locations, and they are moving up their timetable to sell Apple Watches at all of their locations. They said that the Apple Watch demand has been so strong both online and in stores that it's going to put to make sure that they have the smartwatch at even more of their locations as soon as they can do it. So that's not a sign of a failing product that is not selling to people. The numbers may not be the problem for Apple is if they don't have amazing, perfect, world-shattering numbers, then people count it as a failure. And I think I'm inclined to guess that that's why they're not releasing it, because it would just be an excuse for their stock price to go down and people to dump on them.
Did you buy one? Did you buy one, Pete? Do you have an Apple Watch?
No, we talked. Last time when I was there in person and you weren't in, I talked about it. And the thing with it is, first off, you know, even if maybe, you know, I'm sure for some people I have a reputation as an Apple fanboy. I mean, I've used Apple forever, but I very rarely have bought the first gen of their kind of groundbreaking technology. I do have the patience to wait for that second or third one when they really kick it up.
When it's fixed.
Looking at the price, I mean, to get one that would be what I would really want is probably $600 to $900.
You don't want the rose gold one that's $15,000?
Oh God. And the other piece is I work from home. I don't get out all that much. And so I have a phone, I have an iPad, I have a laptop, I have a desktop. I don't have a lot of need for another screen. If I was working outside of the home more, I could see, or having a lot more meetings, I could see where having that information that it makes available to you in a subtle way could be useful. But, you know, there's clocks all over the place in my house, and so I don't need a watch. And so it's just one of those. I'd have to have the kind of cash where that was a impulse buy and do it. And I'm not going to do it on the first gen anyway, because I think there's going to be that's the part I really wonder about. What happens, you know, maybe next year when Apple announces the second gen of this thing and it's got a much better processor and does all kinds of more stuff, what are the people, you know, phones, people are used to kind of cycling through. But if you drop $600 on a watch,
or $10,000 on a watch,
yeah, or more, you don't want that to be now obsolete and everybody can look at yours and tell that it's not the like latest and greatest.
Oh, you have last season's Apple Watch. How droll.
So in other not so good news for Apple, they've initiated a repair program to address blurry iPhone 6 Plus cameras. You know, how to know if your phone has the problem? Well, take a look at your pictures, and if they're all blurry, you may want to check on it. Otherwise, they say that it's only a small number. They call it the EyeSight, the iPhone 6 Plus EyeSight camera, and that is the camera that's on the back of the phone. That's the higher resolution camera, not the selfie cam where you can still see the screen when you're using on it.
Is yours a 6 Plus, Jay? I can't tell.
Yes, it is.
It is. Do you have the EyeSight problem?
The
one we're talking about, the camera, blurry camera issue? You know, being a photographer kind of guy.
I've used it quite a bit to take pictures. I've not had any issues with the camera.
Takes good pictures.
I've also got a 6 Plus, and I haven't seen any problem with focus in the photos.
In fact,
it may be a real small problem, but they did.
It's like, why did I buy this $2,000 lens? This phone's pretty good.
And finally, and this one, I think part of why I included it is because I think that this will be interesting going towards the future. Adobe is going to introduce a new version of Photoshop for iOS, particularly for iOS this October. You know, obviously they're the kings of image editing on the desktop. On mobile, it's more of an afterthought, and Adobe's been trying to change that over the past couple of years as it rolls out more and more free mobile apps that break out some of the more impressive desktop features. So now it's taking a serious crack at bringing a single powerful editing tool to mobile. According to CNET, it's a Photoshop-branded app for the iPhone and iPad that will be a free app this October with an Android version coming later. It's going to have a lot of powerful and commonly used features from desktop Photoshop, like content-aware fill and spot healing. But it's supposed to make them more accessible, which, you know, the interesting thing is there are a lot of people who stay away from using Photoshop because it is a pro tool. And there is a learning curve to it to really get the most out of it. But if you've got it on an iPad and kids are going to play with it in a touch environment and be able to use Photoshop caliber tools, I think that's going to be a big deal as you go forward. That's why I thought this was an important story.
The question that I've got about this, Pete, is are they going to make, knowing how terrible Adobe is at basically everything that they do, are they going to make Photoshop for iOS available through the Mac App Store or through the iTunes App Store? Are they going to write their own App Store and their own installer and make it so that you have to jump through terrible, stupid hoops in order to install it? That's mostly a joke, but only most.
Good question. I wonder. Well, with it being free in October, I have a feeling that might be something that comes, you know, that might be in the Apple, in the App Store. But yeah, I wonder, because their model has been towards the subscription model.
Yeah, and they're like the one company too. Like if you're still sad enough to have Flash installed on your computer, especially if you're using a Mac, doesn't centrally update, doesn't use the built-in update mechanisms, pops up a big stupid message in the middle of what you're doing and doesn't silently update. Hey, would you like to update? You're out of date. Your computer has giant security holes in it now. Why don't you stop what you're doing for like 20 minutes and click here and install this instead of whatever you were about to do?
Oh, wow. Yeah. They're not dumbing it down too much. There's apparently a lot going on under the hood. While you're editing it in your tablet, it treats the edited photos like a flat image. But apparently it saves the edits into separate layers that can be synced back to the desktop. So it would let you do a bit of work on the go with a tablet and then, you know, without ruining your ability to do to do the serious work on your desktop. They did have an attempt at this before called Photoshop Touch, but that app was recently discontinued. CNET's report makes it sound like this new tool could take its place as Adobe's mobile star. Adobe's acknowledged that most people use focused single-purpose apps on mobile. It's much easier to pop into an app dedicated to applying filters or framing photos than digging for those tools in a giant editor. So this app may still be positioned as a step up for people who are looking to do a bit more with photo editing. But, you know, since it's free, we'll definitely, I know I'll definitely be downloading it and taking a look at it just to see see what you get with it. So, and you think about the kids, you know, when you hand that to a bunch of kids where they're used to using a touch screen to do photo editing, and then where they're used to it as a toy like that, I just think that's going to open up, in the future. That's where they're going to come at this from a very different direction, and I think it's going to be interesting to see what happens.
Well, there's a group of people, there's a small subsection of people that do photo editing using like a Wacom tablet or something like that, where they can basically apply brushes and filters and stuff using either their hand or stencil on a tablet, which then, you know, applies it to the image on the screen. So the idea of maybe being able to do that on a touch screen and be able to use your finger, that could be interesting.
Yeah, because it's the Cintiq line, I think, where Wacom has actual, where the screen is on the tablet or on the touchpad.
I believe that's right, yes.
And it is crazy expensive.
Right.
Oh, the Cintiqs, yeah, they're super pricey. They're as expensive as a nice, super nice monitor of that size, but then like more on top of it.
But if you're making your money doing high-end Photoshop, you can afford a Cintiq.
Oh, yeah. Pays for itself. Just bill it to a client or something. The problem with touch input for photo editing is the same problem as touch input for a lot of things. Your finger necessarily obscures the thing you're trying to edit, right? You can't see through your finger. And a lot of apps will do like an offset cursor where you touch like below it and like the crosshair sticks out above it so you can actually like, you know, see what you're doing. But it can be problematic. It's why stylus-based editing on like a Wacom is super popular, but touch-based editing isn't necessarily on all the time.
All right, so that's the apple biting. I think that. So we will go to the next section of the thing. I got to turn the volume back, pump up the volume. I hear Groovehouse. Is he on the phone? No, he's just muttering.
No, we're not trying to do a show here or anything.
In the world of technology, new things come out every day. Our judges will decide whether to try, buy, or fry.
I know Lee mentioned he's testing a 3D printer, but it sounds like MIT has a new one called the MultiFab that they've come up with. That really sounds like a big jump. It's a multi-material 3D printing platform. The competition is very expensive, and they're doing an open platform. The competitive comparison device runs $250,000, but the MultiFab from MIT.
They should call it the MultiFab Corbin Dallas.
MultiFab.
Was thrown together using roughly $7,000 in off-the-shelf parts. And apparently the MIT group accomplished these savings without sacrificing quality. The biggest thing was a big part of the ability to reduce the cost is the 3D scanning module, said Javier Ramos, who's a research engineer on the MultiFab team. More expensive printers have this mechanical system that sweeps every layer and makes sure it's flat and properly laid out. We don't need those extreme mechanical tolerances for this mechanism, given that we use the machine vision system, which is non-contact. So apparently it scans the layer and corrects the layer, so we don't need these very expensive mechanical components. The big thing is that it uses multiple materials, printing with up to 10 of them at a time. The multi-fab can handle everything from lenses to fabrics to fiber optic bundles to complex metamaterials with applications ranging from scientific to aesthetic. In many cases, it spews out improved versions of existing 3D printing achievements. Full-color 3D printers already exist, for instance, but multi-fab appears to be the first to do so without requiring any post-processing. Multifab isn't without its limitations. It's slow for starters. While a smartphone-friendly custom-sized privacy screen takes an hour, a more complex multicolor mini tire takes nearly a day and a half to materialize. And there are the scanner does have problems with some surfaces. But the thing is, this sounds like I like this last paragraph. Is pretty good. It says, so yes, it's disappointing that 3D printing in the home hasn't moved past much past the make your own spork phase. Rest assured, though, that it's getting better every day with applications that will shape your world in multiple material ways. This is the first one. This is the first 3D printer that I've read about that really sounds like it could, that it can do something that would really make a difference. It's better than more than just, you know, doing a plastic figure or, you know, the kind of limited, this seems to show the potential of 3D printing that I hadn't really been seeing in the stuff that's out there so far.
Making a spork with a 3D printer is more a statement about the speed of 3D printing and not so much about the versatility of it.
It's really not all that fast, pretty much.
Right,
no matter
so
what you're
not going to make a fork and a spoon. You might as well do the spork.
Back last 2 years ago, I guess it was, when I brought in those Technology Bites coasters, a year and a half ago, whenever it was. I mean, each one of those is basically a 3 or 4 hour print job.
A labor of love.
No, I just hit the go button and walked away.
A mostly thoughtless gesture that took a lot of time.
There you go. a time-intensive thing that showed my commitment to, like, occasionally glancing at the printer and making sure I didn't misfeed.
Well, and yeah, so now we can finally move on between printing, between having a lovely spork that you made yourself that gives your food the great smell of melted plastic.
Tasty. Just and like mom used to
it's
make.
It's sort of grainy, but I've been trying to find makery type things for Try Buy or Fry. And this one, I don't know if you guys have seen it, but this guy built an overhead control panel for his computer. Essentially, I mean, it's way over the top. It's a Reddit user named Smashcuts. He built this box that he's mounted on the wall at an angle up above his computer. So he reaches up, you know, kind of like the overhead panel in an airplane. But this panel actually controls like his music. It does app launches. There's some useful things it does too. It can launch apps. It can control the volume, change his screen preferences. It has a ton of switches and LEDs. It's powered by an Arduino and a bunch of USB controllers, but it actually really works. And the thing is, he has photos on Imgur that show what it looks like when it's finished, but also more importantly shows how he built it and all that. He's got buttons that he can push that'll basically like insert preset, you know, text into his chat window and stuff like that. And it's the kind of over the top do it because you thought it was cool geeky thing that I think that I have to give people big cred for going through and doing, because it's a fun looking project. You can find a link to it on the Geek Radio website, because this is something you really kind of have to see to. He bought a HAL 9000, the light with the panel around it, off of ThinkGeek and used it as part of the project. So that was a kind of a nifty. And he has a panic button.
What does the panic button do?
I think the panic button plays a segment from, he has it where it plays sound files. And the panic one does something from Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy.
Do you press it when girls are coming and it folds itself up and hides so they don't see it?
You know, that, the
parent.
So, but yeah, he had to use a block and tackle, or he had to use to raise the thing up on its, it weighs a ton. I don't know that I would trust my engineering to hang something like that over my head in a place that I sit for many, many hours. Cause it's made out of like an electrical box, but it looks really good. And, he tells about where he got stuff, like the panels are like laser etched, and so it's just kind of cool. And he obviously this isn't one of those. The other piece to it is he learned as he did it. He's played around with some of this stuff, but he didn't. You know, this is not somebody who has an electrical engineering degree and can solder the wings on a fly kind of thing. So it is plausible that one could learn from what he's done and do your own cool stuff. So, and if it's that easy to make something this kind of cool, then hopefully we're going to see more people doing that kind of neat stuff. I mean, this is, I guess, like the Blinken box on crazy steroids, because it actually does stuff more than blink.
No finger poking, spits and sparking.
And then another one that may be better to read the article, but it does seem like there's sort of an interesting intersection of maker and entertainment. I don't know how many of you have seen the whole escape room thing, or if any of you have done it.
Puzzle rooms where you have to figure out the puzzle to get out of the room.
Yeah.
Oh yeah, it's like mystery dinner murder theater, but
right, but
sort
instead
of different.
You have to like solve complex puzzles. And
yeah, yeah, yeah.
Keys under the clock, found it, gotta go.
And I found a Make Zine online has an article that's got behind the scenes in an escape room. So it's how it works, because to make these things go, there's old techniques, the old things, and then brand new stuff that they're using. Like they're doing magnetic locks, infrared sensors, servo arms, LEDs, Arduinos, and more. Apparently, the part of the deal is these kinds of gadgets have made elaborate setups a lot more possible and affordable. And the room makers leverage creativity, community, and passion, because to figure out how to make the thing really, because it has to really work. It's not just like somebody. It's not like Star Trek where somebody was sitting behind the door, or up on top of the door to make it open and close fast.
If you don't escape, do they leave you in there? Is that it? and that's
well,
like
I'm
your new life?
That's the reason they make sure the group has. Well, no, there's a time limit.
What, before like the walls come together and smash you like in the garbage smasher?
Yeah, they're more creative than that. Now, see, that would be actually you've probably come up with the best answer. If Technology Bites ever did an escape room, you make it where when the hour, you have the countdown going, and when it gets real close to that, then you have them open up a smelly chute into a horrible, horrible environment.
Into the garbage chute.
Escape through here. And so if you don't get out in time, you have to go through the garbage chute and the fake compressing it on you. I don't know. I didn't get a chance to look up if Houston had it, but this seems to be the escape room thing. I've heard about a few people going to them, and it seems like there are a lot of places that it's kind of come back as a thing. They used to have some of this in the past, and now it's back, and people like to solve the puzzles. And it's a big puzzle in person, and it's like all the video games that we've, that people have grown used to. I guess what The Room is probably the most famous current one. So read the article; it tells about how to do it. So see, you can, if you have kids, you can like rig up their rooms so they have to figure out how to escape it and do the puzzles every morning.
Or so they're disappeared without a trace if they don't make it out.
Or maybe I guess the better one is to have solve the puzzles before they can get in and, bother you in your study. And then here's one that I really wonder who's going to try. There's not a buy component to this one. If it's a try or fry. This October, the Hobbit trilogy is going to return to select theaters in the U.S., but they are going to be screening the extended editions. So it will be 9 hours long.
Fry. Good Lord. Maybe if I was 16 or 17 and just, I'm too old for that. Who's got 9 hours to go to a theater and watch 3 movies in a row, and they're not even good movies?
I guess that's the thing. Especially since you're going to end with the most disappointing one, as far as I've seen, the Battle of the Five Armies. Just seemed to me where it just totally went off the rails from the original Hobbit.
Laura and I watched the first one in a theater. I watched the second one on a plane. It was an in-flight movie, and I haven't bothered with the third one. Just zero interest.
Well, yeah, maybe it'll save you the time. My wife, I think, summed it up the best way. She posted it on Facebook, but she said, because this literally happened as we're watching it, it's like, oh, that guy that I don't know who he is, but I like him. Just die, or don't let him die.
Were there barrels? Was the dragon defeated after a 30-minute barrel ride down a waterfall that just never ended?
No, the barrel thing happened earlier.
I know. It just felt like it was still going on. It just felt like that part.
I
of
see.
The
dragon.
Hours.
The dragon is defeated with. You know, I'm not spoiling it.
Spoilers from 1938 or something.
No, the dragon was killed relatively early in the in it. The thing to me, quick side movie review. It seemed like there's much more stuff that's cut from the whole cloth in this one than there were in the previous ones. The previous movies had more pieces that actually you could find something like it in The Hobbit. And it seemed to me like this one that Peter Jackson kind of went and found chunks of story that he repurposed that were in like the Lord of the Rings and in the Silmarillion and some of the other books and like reworked them to put them in for this story. And it came off as just a horrible mishmash that didn't, I guess. So it's a battle of these armies, and
are there 5 armies?
I will. You know what? At a certain point, I was trying to figure out to count. There must be, or they wouldn't have put it in the title. But it's kind of, it's like what the second movie in the Lord of the Rings trilogy with the whole Battle of Helm's Deep.
Yeah.
That was 100 kinds of awesome.
Yeah, absolutely.
I loved that one. The extended version is even better. This seemed like it felt like they took pieces of that and, oh, hey, it worked in that, so let's use it here. It's just it didn't fit with what the story, it didn't naturally flow in the story, and it didn't have any meaning. It's just kind of, oh, wait, here's some more people who are going to fight. And it came off as, another spoiler. The 5 armies don't kind of come in at different times. And so there's sort of the constant, oh, well, this has happened. Oh, but wait, there's another army. kind of thing. And so it's not.
No, thanks. So no, I certainly wouldn't want to spend 9 hours doing that. I mean, Jay, you were alive in the 70s. I guess Peter was too. Would you have done it even back then? 9 hours in a movie theater watching 3 3-hour movies back to back?
In the 70s? Okay.
Somebody's shown all 3 Star Wars movies together.
Oh, that's different.
No. Let me make an observation. If the 3 Hobbit movies with the production value they have now were presented in a theater in the 1970s, I would have camped out for a week to experience that 9 hours.
Literally exploded your brain.
Right. Which actually, kind of like what it was like to see Star Wars the first time.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
When it came out in 1970s. No, but I don't think I could spend 9 hours in a theater.
Not watching The Hobbit. Now, I could do it for...
Of course, in the 70s, I spent a good 3 to 4 hours camping outside of the River Oaks Theater to watch 2 hours of Rocky Horror.
Well, nothing wrong with that.
Nothing wrong with that.
Nothing wrong with that. I've tried to go to when I was in high school. They did I forget where it was. It may have been at River Oaks. They did a back-to-back showing of all. At the time, I guess it was 6. Possibly 7 generations may have just come out, all 7 Star Trek movies. And that was like an all-night thing. It was like start at 7 p.m., end at like 9 a.m. the next day kind of thing. I didn't make it, and I don't think any of my friends actually made it too. By the time Star Trek V rolled around, we were all basically dead in the theater.
Even though you could like take a nap through some of them, like skipping the, was it the odd-numbered ones that tended to be the...
Yeah. Well,
not so good.
Yeah, it was rough. It was a rough thing, even for a spry teenage version of me.
Watching the constant evolution of Shatner's toupee.
watching everybody just get progressively weirdly old.
And some of the plots to just get really, really crappy.
Yeah, Star Trek 6 just didn't really hold together all that well when you kind of try to analyze it, and Star Trek 4 at least was funny, and it just kind of got all weird after that.
Yeah, I guess, well, The Undiscovered Country, which one, was that 6?
It's a 6, yeah.
Was okay.
I mean, it had a good heart, and it had some great feel-good moments, but it was just kind of just had a little bit of nonsensicalness to it.
Yeah, well, after the steaming pile that was, what does God need with a starship?
That was William Shatner directing, God help us all.
And I think, didn't he have a lot to do with the story?
I think he got his hooks into it and changed it around quite a bit from what it originally was, yeah.
And so the funny, just not to digress too far, but the funny thing on that is... there's Harlan Ellison has a lot of books where he's just got like his kind of his nonfiction writings. And he, when Star Trek V came out, I wondered about this because he talked about when they were trying to do Star Trek I, you know, Roddenberry, you know, they pulled all these like writers, and Harlan Ellison did City on the Edge of Forever, the one of the kind of most edgy,
yeah, and I think
interesting.
He sued. There was all kinds of lawsuits and weird stuff wrapped up in that too. That particular
episode. So they got all the writers from the good writers they could find, and especially people who had participated in Star Trek before and all that. And you know, apparently the this is Harlan Ellison writing from his point of view, and he can, on the one hand, he's a bastard, and on the other hand, he is a insanely talented and creative bastard.
Harlan Ellison is like the mirror universe evil version of like Andy Rooney.
But he said that Roddenberry, every time anybody had an idea, that Roddenberry would like say, no, bigger, it has to be bigger. And finally Harlan Ellison was like, okay, they go to the edge of the universe and they blast through the edge of the universe, and on the other side is God or a child or both. And then Roddenberry said that that wasn't big enough or something, and Ellison flipped him off and left.
Well,
but then I heard about that, and it's like, oh, somebody picked that one up off the floor and dusted it off and put some more stuff with it.
Well, remember the whole plot, the central plot of the first Star Trek movie, Star Trek the Motion Picture, was recycled from the aborted Star Trek Phase 2 TV series that they tried to put together, and it and it kind of imploded in on itself. Some of that went to Next Generation, but and was sort of held over, but a lot of it, the idea of the the V'ger, the probe that went out and came back as a malevolent god, machine entity was taken from Star Trek Phase 2 that was going to be the pilot for that show.
Well, they'd actually had, there's an episode of the classic one where the satellite that they sent, a satellite that they sent out came back and it was trying to, it had the whole thing about the creator and what was the name of that episode where it thought that James T. Kirk, because the person, the creator was James T. Kirk or something like that, you know, T-E-A or, and so it mistook the, and
Nomad.
Since it was the 60s.
The probe was Nomad.
Yeah, since it was the 60s, it was basically a metal can looking satellite on a fishing line that floated around in the
talked like this. All robots talk like this.
So it go. So they did it a little better in the Star Trek the Motion Picture, but that Star Trek the Motion Picture just almost killed it. You know, Wrath of Khan really, if that hadn't come out and been what it was, they wouldn't have made any more Star Trek movies.
Exactly. That was, well, and that was Nick Meyer's intention going into Star Trek II, was to make Battleship Potemkin in space, and they really did. Although Roddenberry objected always to the militarization, the militarization of Starfleet and the Federation portrayed, the change in uniforms to the, which I honestly think were the best Star Trek uniforms ever, those red military-style coveralls with the little white strap that they had. So cool, especially after the pajamas they were wearing in Star Trek.
The baggy, horrible,
it was
the unitard future.
We thought the future was going to be like that in the 70s.
Well, there's, while we're trekking out, I guess there's been sort of a documentary series about the different Star Treks, and they got up to the Next Generation, and apparently it is a very frank discussion of the issues of Star Trek the Next Generation, and Roddenberry just about wrecked it because he didn't, in his vision, there was no conflict.
Yeah, the future was, you know, semi-utopian and everything was wonderful.
And so, which that can be cool as your dream of, you know, a heavenly utopian future, but from the standpoint of drama and entertainment, it's a little dry.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, you know who cut his teeth doing television on Star Trek The Next Generation and whose episodes were among the best was Ronald D. Moore, who would go on to give us Battlestar Galactica and all kinds of other amazing stuff.
That I did not know.
Yeah, Ronald D. Moore did a lot of the truly great episodes of Star Trek The Next Generation were written by Ron D. Moore, among others. Great guy.
Well, it sounds like Roddenberry's like advisor was like a lawyer or something that he had, who got increasingly influential, and they would have him like mark. He was marking up scripts with his comments.
Really?
Yeah, it was that really amateur hour, but you know, according there's articles on it. It bears reading about. It was about 2 or 3 months ago that I think it came out.
Well, yeah, Roddenberry had a very set way he wanted the future to be. It was supposed to be sort of, not free of conflict, but, you know, kind of very peaceful. Everybody, no one wants for anything. We don't use money anymore. Everybody has jobs and has as much food as they want, and the Starfleet is out there patrolling the galaxy. And sure, there's hostile aliens from time to time, but for the most part, everybody just kind of gets along, and that sounds like, you know, that's a wonderful vision for the future. That would be totally cool. But from a TV show standpoint, that's kind of dull.
Yeah, really. It's like Jane. It's like English period pieces. It would be, you know, the big conflict for the episode is that we've run out of Klingon tea.
Well, if you go back and watch some of the first season episodes of Star Trek The Next Generation, some of them are like that. Or, oh my gosh, we've been trapped in the holodeck again. How many times did that come up? Stupid holodeck. It's like the most unsafe thing. It's like kills more people than the transporter, and yet it's on every ship, and even the kids are using it.
Fantasy death trap.
Well, and The Ferengi were an interesting concept that then, when executed, became comically
stupid.
That it sounds like some of the parts that were particularly irritating about them were Roddenberry stuff. There was a whole he had a whole that was something I read on this that he had a whole long explanation about Ferengi sexuality and all this stuff. And it was kind of like not one bit of it would be appropriate or possible to put on television.
Well, The Next Generation had several episodes that got kind of more risque into, you know, sexuality than was kind of normal on a syndicated TV show in the mid to in the late 80s. I guess 87 was when it came on. I mean, at growing up in 87, I was 9 years old. And so Star Trek, you know, it came on, what did it come on, Friday nights or something here in Houston. And we would all, like, you know, kind of me and my mom, my dad, my brother, we would all watch Star Trek together. It was a big family thing and it was great. And every once in a while they would do like a weird episode, like the one with the planet where everybody has sex with everybody else and Wesley knocks over the fence into the flower garden and like has to be put to death and is saved at the last minute. And that whole episode was like, you know, scantily clad people falling all over each other and groping and making, you know, sexy talk. And like when you're 9 years old, sitting there with your mom and your dad watching this on TV, that just is really uncomfortable.
Or the, the hermaphrodite culture where Riker ends up in some
Riker figures out a way to get into the pants of an alien, even though their race like has no gender. He manages it anyway, because that's how Riker he is. He's going to sleep with something before this episode is over.
Oh, and well, and so here's the last try by or fry.
Oh, right, that's right. We have other stuff to talk about. Right.
This one is available for pre-order from Indiegogo, so it's a real thing. It's a heads-up car display that does do what its name suggests. It's a transparent screen that you would mount on the dashboard of your car. And essentially, so now you can turn your old clunker into a kind of modern gadget-filled vehicle like most people get brand new now. Apparently, it has Google Maps-powered GPS navigation, a built-in dash cam, an included OBD scanner for diagnostics, phone integration with access to contacts, calls, text, notifications, and music, and thanks to a 4G LTE connection, it has the ability to function as a Wi-Fi hotspot. You control it via gestures and voice control, so there's no buttons to push and no reason to take your eyes off the road.
This is kind of cool. I'm still trying to get the page to load here to look at it. There we go.
The pre-order is it's under $300 on the pre-order thing. And, you know, some of those functions, adding some of those things, there's a lot of cars that don't have them and it could be nice.
Yeah. But, I tested one of these out, a year ago from Garmin, totally different, like not this one obviously, but a dashboard heads up display that you add aftermarket. And it was terrible. It was like, it was absolutely nothing like this. It was like a couple of little, it was like the kind of liquid crystal displays that go on like your bedroom alarm clock, like reflected up onto like your windshield to show you like how fast you were going and what direction you were going in. And like, that was basically it. This looks really, really neat.
Yeah, I think that, you know, this is sort of, I think this comes into kind of the Internet of Things type stuff. Obviously, they're meeting a different goal, but it's certainly a creative use of the technology. And the thing I wonder, though, is, you know, how hard is it to, like, wire it into your stereo and get it all hooked in to installed so that you can use it? But
not too hard for you, Pete.
I don't think I would add this into my car. I'd be interested in seeing it, but I don't think. I think I would rather get a new vehicle that has these functions already in it than try to. Yeah, but in a like really old car though, it might be fun to try and we'll sort of retroize it. You know, if you had like an old 50s car, you make it so it pops up in something that looks like an old TV set from the 50s.
Ooh, there you go.
Would be kind of cool. Or
a big wooden cabinet that kind of pops up in between everything.
Yeah. But
no, I might buy that. It would depend upon it depends on how expensive it's going to be. And like you said, the ease of integration. I mean, if it's like connect it to your car's Bluetooth and boom, it works, then okay, that's kind of neat. But if it's like rip your dashboard out and run 15 different lines, 15 different taps, get a custom wiring harness that you have to get that's incompatible with your car unless you get the second wiring harness from the manufacturer, and in the end you've like connected something wrong and your car won't start, then yeah, maybe not.
So I guess we'd put that under try or guarded try.
Yeah,
I'd try it in my Tesla.
Don't need it in your Tesla.
Yeah, really.
Tesla's magical and runs on.
It's actually smaller. It's smaller than the screen that they've built into the dash in the center console of a Tesla. I don't know. Some of it is. I've got an 87 Shelby CSX, the old turbo thing, and I'm actually kind of. I like the fact that there is no automatic anything in it. It's a 5-speed. The windows are crank windows to roll down. The radio has got a cassette in it. It's very 1987, but it just seems like it'd be really weirdly anachronistic to put the heads up thing in it. I guess better would be if it was totally, if you didn't have the heads up display, if it was all just voice command stuff or where it's all hidden, would be a way that you could update an older car like that without changing the look of it, but adding the kind of cool smart functions.
Especially if your older car was a black 1982 Trans Am with a flashy red light in front.
There you go. And you could take with an Arduino, you could make it be probably as smart as the car they used in the show.
Just about at this point, probably. Although it wouldn't have William Daniels voice acting. And it's there just not go. Kit without William Daniels voice acting.
Although you could maybe get sound files from the show.
And have the Arduino play them. See, now you're thinking, why haven't we done this?
Of course, it kind of sucked because you'd have to like tell it to tell you the stuff. It's not like it was going to really notice, hey, this situation really calls for this snappy quip.
So you're telling me I still can't live out my childhood fantasy of driving my own Knight Rider car around and having it respond and be my one true friend.
Not until you have the money to have William Daniels sit in the back seat and riff on the whatever stuff the car is supposed to say.
He's pretty old, too.
Have him sitting in the back with a microphone. And, am I supposed to call you Michael? You know, that's an extra 50.
We've been driving for hours. Can't we please go home now? I'm so tired.
I need to
and
get
hungry.
my oil changed.
Need my pills.
Slower.
All right. Well, things are winding down here. I think we'll be.
Oh, there it is. There's the music.
Ah, yes. You know, I was as we close out and talk about try buy or fry and stuff. You know, my car. I've decided that I'm not going to get a new car when I finish paying off this car. I'm going to enjoy not having a car note for a little while, so I'll pay this car off next year. But what always irritates me is the advances in technology that come out for the cars in terms of pairing with Bluetooth and giving you access to Siri and stuff. And I finally stumbled upon the fact that I can actually upgrade my system in my car for less than it would cost to buy a new car. So, you know, keep in mind that upgrades are still a good option.
Indeed.
Oh, they can be. I've got a 2006. It's a Caddy. And the sad thing is there's no way to put in auxiliary sound without, like, tearing out the dashboard and doing all kinds of extra stuff that's not really worth it.
Well, apparently that really nice interface is about a $600 part. Gotta go. We're out of time.
Should we be talking through this part of the music?
No, we shouldn't be. Okay. You've been listening to Technology Bites. I'm Jay Lee.
I'm Peter Hughes.
I'm Flicted.
I'm Lee.
And he's
Brewhouse.
We'll see you next Wednesday night.
You hear a lot in the news about the 1% and the power they've got. Well, KPFT wants you to be part of a 1% this hour. You can help power independent music and ideas in the process. KPFT's crowdfunding campaign is underway. We're raising money to land a new transmitter, which means the radio you love will be heard stronger and farther than ever before. And with this campaign still going strong, we can go over the goal and pay back the debt that KPFT has incurred to bring you great radio all day, all year long. Just giving 1% toward our goal is $200. Please visit kpft.org and click the blue button on the right to donate. Thank you. This is KPFT Houston.
Help KPFT day or night every time you shop. Your grocery store's loyalty card can be associated with KPFT, and you can support the station anytime you buy at no additional cost to you. At Kroger, bring the barcode printed on your member packet from kpft.org, then scan it along with your Kroger Plus card each time you go to the register. You'll be donating to KPFT every time you shop. At Randall's, simply visit customer service to link your Randall's Remarkable card to KPFT's organization number 4931. That's 4931. 1% of your purchase will go to KPFT each time you shop. If you missed any of that information, you can visit kpft.org to learn more. This is 90.1 KPFT Houston. KPFT.org.